Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. My name is Lauren Litton, and I am the host of the show. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That is 347-994-1149. Press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you will be placed in the queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. I hope everyone has been enjoying the summer. Ohio's legislators were busy this summer passing House Bill 86, which we will refer to as HB 86, leading Ohio on its way to sweeping sentencing reform. Although this type of reform didn't happen overnight, in this political climate, to have such bipartisan support is truly unique. On June 29th, Ohio's Governor John Kasich signed the historic bill that becomes effective at the end of September. Governor Kasich described this piece of legislation as perhaps the most important thus far in his tenure because it goes directly towards helping people improve their lives. While this bill overhauls the approach to the adult criminal justice system, it also encompasses reforms in the juvenile arena. It is projected that the entire reform bill will save Ohio taxpayers $46.3 million during the next 3 years. And I'm going to just read a few quotes about the legislation. Judge Teresa Delick of Mahoning County Juvenile Court and president of the Ohio Association of Juvenile Court Judges has said, "These reforms will mitigate placing kids on a conveyor belt to adult crime. And while the changes in HB 86 do not solve all juvenile justice system issues, they will aid in providing better outcomes for children. The ACLU of Ohio describe it as common sense reforms. And Progress Ohio has stated that HB 86 takes a giant step towards reform of Ohio's juvenile justice system in a way that protects communities, gives juveniles a better shot at reclaiming their lives, and saves state taxpayers millions of dollars going forward." So while it's not yet in effect, we wanted to bring attention to the juvenile justice-related pieces of this legislation. And today's guests were instrumental in shaping those provisions of the legislation and are here to share their perspectives about the potential impact of HB 86 and how these changes fit into the larger public policy reform efforts happening in Ohio and across the country. So today we have with us Jill Beeler, who is the Chief Counsel for the Juvenile Division in the Office of the Ohio Public Defender. Jill has served on the Competency Working Group of the Supreme Court of Ohio Advisory Committee on Mentally Ill in the Courts and is a member of the Supreme Court of Ohio Advisory Committee on Children, Families, and the Courts. She earned her undergraduate degree in criminology and criminal justice from The Ohio State University and her law degree from Capital University. And Gabriella Celeste is the Director of Child Policy at Case Western Reserve University Schubert Center for Child Studies, where she helps to identify and implement strategies to bridge child-related research, education, policy, and practice, and to enhance community partnerships to promote effective public policy and practice for the well-being of children. After completing her Juris Doctorate at the University of Michigan Law School, Gabriella co-founded the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana, an advocacy and legal reform organization successfully pushing for effective and sustainable alternatives to institutionalization for youth. So I wanted to welcome both of you to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Gabrielle, perhaps you can start us out by providing some background on how this legislation came into being and why the circumstances in Ohio are amenable to accept this type of reform.
Sure. So thanks again for having us on this show. And I just want to say at the outset, there have been so many folks who've been a huge part of this effort. I hope Jill and I can do it some justice in sharing our perspectives, but certainly there were so many folks involved, and maybe we'll get an opportunity to acknowledge them, in addition certainly to the governor's leadership, later in the show. But so I think there are, you know, two ways to answer that question. I mean, one is that there's just a compelling set of facts in Ohio that really made our state ripe for reform right now. And then secondly, there's really been a number of activities that have occurred that have created a context in Ohio where reform could really occur. So maybe starting with just some of the facts and what we know about serving young people in Ohio and the challenges and opportunities here. Let me just share a few things, and perhaps, Jill, you want to share some thoughts on that too. So we know that right now, Ohio, the Ohio Department of Youth Services is the state department that really is responsible for the care and treatment of youth who are adjudicated delinquent in Ohio. So I'll refer to that as DYS. And DYS right now spends about $123,000 a year, in fact, more than $123,000 a year to confine a single youth in a state correctional facility. That's about, you know, $340 a day. That's a lot of money that we're spending. And what we know is that the recidivism rate for those youth is unfortunately quite high. By 3 years out, over half of those youth, research shows, will reoffend. The other reality, though, we have in Ohio is we have proven effective community programs that cost, on average, about $10,000 per youth annually. For example, multisystemic therapies is an example of a program that has been shown to be very effective with serious and violent juvenile offenders and could be creating major savings for taxpayers and crime victims. The other reality we have in Ohio is that a number of folks have come together many, many years ago to create something called Reclaim. And without defining it in great detail, Reclaim really is now a nationally recognized model that is a cost-sharing model between the state and local jurisdictions that really works to keep appropriate youth in their community rather than being sent to more costly state institutions. And so the fact that we have this model, we have effective programs, is good news, despite the fact that we still have been spending a lot of money on youth who could be better served in community placements. So one last fact I just sort of want to leave us with is that I think despite what people may get a sense of from the media, juvenile violent crime is down nationally, and it's down in Ohio, and it's been declining basically since about the mid-90s, around 1994. So when you look at all of these facts and you also look at our state economic sort of picture and climate, it seemed like there were a lot of reasons why this was a really good time to do something about young people in our juvenile justice system. Jill, did you want to add anything to that one?
Well, I would only add that to sort of go along with what Gabriella was saying in terms of the cost of DYS commitments, that really that is the movement that Ohio has been living with the last decade or so, and that is a lot of legislation that's gone through the General Assembly has really focused on criminalizing youth behavior and passing laws that result in more kids being transferred to the adult criminal system, or mandatory sentencing laws that really increase the amount of time a child may serve in the Department of Youth Services or even in local detention facilities. And so that over-incarceration or criminalization of the juvenile justice system is really what took effect throughout the last 10 or 15 years. And so hopefully what we're starting to see with House Bill 86 is a swing in the opposite direction and a movement away from that.
Yeah, and to just pick up on that point, when you think about the national context, that's absolutely something we've seen nationally. The other, though, to answer the other part of the question about why I think 86, why now was a good time for 86, given where Ohio's at and what's been happening, nationally there has been in a number of states an effort and a movement to swinging back some of those more draconian laws and efforts, recognizing that it's not serving either the public or the youth effectively, and it's not been a good use of our public dollars. So I think Ohio has been both a leader in this, but also been consistent with some of what we're seeing nationally, and not just in states, you know, like New York or Connecticut and Illinois, but also states like Texas and Louisiana and Florida. So that's a part of the context. And if, just a few other things. Ohio, back in about almost 10 years ago, it was 2004 when there was a lawsuit filed regarding the how kids are being treated in the juvenile justice system through DYS. As a result of that, the state really, in its wisdom, chose to take a more collaborative approach and develop with the folks who filed the lawsuit a stipulation agreement that has a major plan of things in place that they need, that they're trying to do to respond to the challenges raised in that lawsuit. And so DYS has, you know, a number of things have been done, including looking at their release authority, how kids come in and out of that system, looking at their behavioral health and juvenile justice programming, looking at their assessment system. They've worked with the University of Cincinnati in creating something called the Ohio Youth Assessment System, or the OYAS tool. Looking at programming, they've created, working with folks at Kent State now at Case Western Reserve, Begun Center, for the Behavioral Health and Juvenile Justice Initiative, and a targeted reclaim strategy. So there have been a number of efforts in place, both by DYS, but also by advocates. The Children's Law Center has been very active in raising issues and concerns for many years now. So, and in fact, there was legislation in the last session that really took up a number of the concerns that have been sort of percolating and coming to the top. That legislation, however, didn't go anywhere, and so now we are, I think, very grateful to be looking at 86 as law here in Ohio.
I just wanted to let our listeners know, since you mentioned the litigation, that is what's known as SH v. Stickrath, and we had a show last year if people wanted to listen in on that, and we plan to have one this year on an update, and there's also information on the Children's Law Center. I'd like to sort of now turn our attention to actually what HB 86 encompasses, because it's been said to establish a uniform competency statute, reverse some transfers of youth sent to the adult system, restore discretion of juvenile courts. But what, in fact, does it cover and what does it do?
Okay, so I'll start, and then, again, I'll sort of hand it over to Jill maybe on more specifics. So very broadly speaking, it really does three things. I mean, just to say broadly, it invests in what works. It invests in what we know what works. It realigns dollars to support those smart investments, and it has created statutory changes to really reduce the pipeline of youth who'd be better served in the community from these correctional facilities. So it does that broadly. What it specific, a little bit more specifically, what we mean by investing in what works, it promotes, there's language that's been added to the reclaim formula, what I talked about before, where it really promotes research-supported outcome-based programs and services, you know, in our local communities. And also, it creates an interagency mental health and juvenile justice task force to address some of the challenges of delinquent youth who suffer from serious mental illness, which is a major concern in our juvenile justice system and really across the country. It also provides, I should go into the sentencing reform and the judicial practice piece, but Jill, why don't you take that up and talk a bit about those specifics?
Okay. So House Bill 86 really includes four major changes to Ohio's juvenile justice code. And some of those changes are in regards to sentencing and some more procedural. But the first big change for Ohio is the inclusion of what's known as a reverse waiver option. And reverse waiver refers to kids who have been sent into the adult criminal system by way of mandatory bindover. And the way that generally works is based on the offense that the child is charged with, and that decision is made by the prosecutor's office. if the prosecutor charges an offense that triggers the mandatory bindover, then that child will be transferred to the adult criminal system after a showing of probable cause. So there's very little for the juvenile judge to do in a mandatory bindover case. They have very little decision-making ability and very few options that, if it is a child, the judge may want to retain in the juvenile system. Oftentimes they find that they are not able to do that, and because of the mandatory nature of the law, those children go into the adult system. What the reverse waiver will do is, if a child goes to the criminal system by way of mandatory bindover but is later convicted of or pleads guilty to a lesser offense, to an offense that would not trigger or would not have triggered the mandatory bindover, then that child will be returned to the juvenile court and potentially receive a juvenile sentence and be able to remain in the juvenile system. Now, the prosecutor will be allowed to object, and at that point, the juvenile court will have a hearing, at which time be very similar to what's known as an amenability hearing. Evidence will be put before the court. The defense will be able to argue all the reasons why the child should remain in the juvenile system. The state will argue why they feel that the adult sentence is appropriate. And at that point, it will come down to the judge making the decision as to really where that child should serve their sentence, if it should be in the juvenile or the adult system. So that's very new for Ohio. It's going to feel very different, I think, for a while. And there's a lot of back and forth, if you will, from juvenile and the adult courts. But it's not a new concept nationally. And one thing that I hope people will understand is that we did consult with Campaign for Youth Justice when we were discussing the possibilities of having a reverse waiver. And they have really seen this work in other states. And they've seen a number of children returned back to the juvenile justice system because essentially they shouldn't have been transferred to the adult system in the first place. And that's the bottom line. Is if they shouldn't be tried as an adult, then they should be given that opportunity to return to the juvenile court. The second significant change is a provision that will expand the opportunities for kids who are in DYS to apply for early release. They'll have two additional options, which they don't have currently in Ohio law. And those are an ability to apply to their court for an early release during a gun specification sentence. Currently, that's considered to be what the kids call mandatory time. And what they mean by that is they're not able to be released by DYS or by their judge. And so this will allow them the opportunity, as long as they serve 1 year of their specification, they'll be able to apply to the court and ask the judge to release them. And the other opportunity, which they currently do not have, is the opportunity to ask their judge for release after they serve their minimum sentence. And so currently in Ohio, once the child serves their minimum 6 month or minimum 1 year sentence in DYS, then the court loses jurisdiction over that child and can no longer order their release. And this will allow the child to file a motion on their own or through counsel or through a family member asking the court to release even after they've served that minimum sentence. Another sentencing reform is regarding the gun specification sentencing. And what current law does is if a child is involved in an offense that also included a firearm, whether or not the child provided, used, or disposed, or ever touched the firearm, or even regardless of whether they even knew one of their co-defendants may have a firearm, that child is subject to the same mandatory sentencing as the adult or juvenile who did, in fact, use the firearm in the commission of the offense. So the new provision will require that if the child did not use, provide, or dispose of the firearm, they'll only be subject to a discretionary sentence meaning the judge does not have to commit them to DYS on that offense. And if the judge chooses to do the commitment, it'll be for a period of up to 1 year. And so that should significantly limit the lengthy mandatory sentences that some kids were receiving, for example, 2 or 3 years on gun specifications when they never even had or potentially even knew about the firearm in the commission of the offense. And last but not least is the passage of the juvenile competency statutes. And this is very significant for Ohio. One reason is because it's an area of the law that has been worked on by a number of stakeholders and advocates for at least the past 10 years. It's an issue that there's been a lot of consensus on around the fact that we as a state need a competency statute to apply to juveniles in juvenile court. But it's never anything that's actually come to fruition until the passage of House Bill 86. So the competency is actually a set of 9 statutes that should walk defense attorneys, prosecutors, courts, and others through the process from requesting the competency evaluation to the determination of competency, and then what happens after that, depending on if the child is found competent or not. It also lays out very specific time frames for things to happen, whether it's requests or hearings, evaluations, time frames for if a child is found to be able to attain competency. There's a time frame that will be, for example, if the child is held in detention, they'll only be able to be held for a certain period of time. It doesn't go on forever. And it also includes a juvenile-specific standard that will hopefully guide courts in determining whether a child is competent. And I should add that competency means that the person who's been charged, the juvenile in this situation, understands the nature of the proceedings against them and that they're able to assist in their defense. So the competency statute actually specifically designates 4 areas where a juvenile may be incompetent, and those include if it's due to mental illness, intellectual disability, developmental disability, or otherwise due to a lack of mental capacity. So those are our juvenile-specific standards that will hopefully be able to guide courts through that process and a determination whether that child understands the proceedings that are being held against them and that they're able to assist in their defense.
Great. And just you going through that, it makes me, I want to read Judge Linda Tucci-Teodosio, who is a judge in Summit County Juvenile Court, her testimony in favor of the bill, because I think it highlights the philosophy of some of these reforms. In her testimony, she said, the juvenile justice system is unique in that it has as its goal the rehabilitation of youth. These children will be returning to our communities at the latest upon their 21st birthdays. We owe it to the citizens of our communities to take advantage of the many tools that exist for the assessment of youth and give judges the discretion that they need to effectively address the needs of each individual youth depending on their particular circumstances. That is what you or I would expect for our own children should they become involved in the juvenile justice system. We should settle for nothing less for those who come to the courthouses around our state on a daily basis. So is there anything that either of you want to add about how these reforms like, correspond to what we know to be true about what is good for youth?
Well, I'd certainly say that we are moving toward, a set of policies that recognizes basic principles of adolescent development, and that having a developmental perspective when we are looking at what's going to be most effective with young people is smart. I mean, to be smart on juvenile crime really requires that kind of approach. So in that regard, I think a lot of the details that Jill just described is really putting the tools in place to move us toward that kind of individualized developmentally informed approach.
I know it's really early to tell, but what are the projected long-term impacts of HB 86 passage? Any thoughts?
Well, I would say easy questions. To some extent, there's going to be a learning curve for the practitioners, and House Bill 86 is a place for us to start, I hope. It's a first step in what I do hope will be additional reform efforts. And again, the idea of moving away from mandatory sentencing and sending so many children into the adult system, bringing back judicial discretion, this allows us the first opportunity to really put some of those concepts in action and to provide for that individualized case determination, to stress the importance that judges should be the ones who are ultimately making the decisions as to where the child should, if they're adjudicated, serve their sentence. It shouldn't come down to the prosecutor's decision in what to charge the child with, but to allow the defense an opportunity to advocate for their client, the state to present their side of the case, and then for the judge ultimately to make that decision. And not only just in the broad sense, but the importance of that individualized determination. Because the whole theory behind the juvenile justice system is to look at the child that is standing in the courtroom and to decide, what is happening with this child? Why are they making poor decisions? What is going on in their life? And how can we help that child get on a better path? And a lot of these kids going through the system, we all know, are dealing with some common struggles, but at the same time, they're all going through their own individual struggles. And some of those may be learning disabilities or mental health issues. Some kids start using drugs and alcohol at a very young age, and then the combination of those, or their families may be struggling, and the economy right now doesn't help those situations either. And so to give the court an opportunity to look at the child that's standing before them and to determine what treatment may help this child and this family, that's going to be not only a better outcome from for the child, but for the family and then for the community, believing that will lead to lower recidivism and lower cost implications if the child can be given treatment without necessarily incarcerating them. And so those are some of the long-term goals that we hope to see. I do think there'll be a learning curve involved, and especially for some of the newer provisions like the competency and the reverse waiver. And so we really need to start collecting good data on how these provisions are working, what's working well, and what may need to be fixed later on down the road. And really, is the reverse waiver, for example, bringing kids back to the juvenile system? Is it something that's being successful? And so learning about cases and information and stories is going to be very important for us so we know where to go from here.
Well, we did have a question, I guess, that relates to the impact, wondering if any one or agency entity is going to be responsible for monitoring the impact of the bill. And Jill, you just mentioned, the collection of data and how important that is. I don't know if you have any thoughts about if the Ohio Public Defender's Office is looking for attorneys to be already sending information in. So what are the thoughts that either of you have on that?
Well, I can say for my agency, we're going to be very interested in learning information, whether it's coming from defense counsel or courts, court personnel, judges, magistrates. Anyone involved in the system who has information that might be helpful to us, we're always going to be interested in learning about that and what's happening in these cases. And we have contacts with various courts and public defender offices and so on and so forth. But just based on how Ohio and the 88 counties and how diverse it is going to be a challenge, I think. And there's no structure to it right now. For example, there's no provision in House Bill 86 that lays out the collection of data. And so I think that's going to be something maybe we look at in the future for some additional legislation.
Yeah, I would just to sort of add on here, I would agree with all of that, and the data piece is a real is a fundamental need. I think there are different ways to go about that, and you know, whether it's local judges or judges in judicial districts, or if it's the Supreme Court that decides they want to monitor pieces of this, certainly DYS, I would expect, while they're not obligated to monitor specifically the impact of the entire bill, there are portions that they're already, for example, the reclaim programming and what jurisdictions are doing around the state, what kind of programming they put in place, the portions of this, the language in this bill would give them an opportunity to continue to pay attention to that and work with local jurisdictions to help improve practices where they'd like to. Also, the task force that's created, the Mental Health Juvenile Justice Task Force, has a very short window with a number of requirements over the course of that time. So that window is, I believe it's like September 30th, with them reporting to the governor and the legislature with a report the end of March of next year, so about 6 months, to take a very detailed look at how kids with mental health needs are being treated in the system. And so the Ohio Department of Mental Health, along with the Ohio Department of Health of Youth Services, are really responsible for helping to lead that effort moving forward, and there's a data collection piece involved there. So hopefully there'll be an opportunity for follow-up with that. The other thing, though, that this speaks to is that there's such a huge educational piece to this legislation. And, you know, whether it's the general public and understanding the impact, and programs like this hopefully help us do that, but also all of the stakeholders that Jill mentioned. And it's not just the lawyers and the judges. It's juvenile court administrators. It's treatment providers. It's potentially child and adolescent forensic psychologists who may be doing competency evaluations. You know, there are just a lot of people who are invested in trying to make young people have better opportunities for success. And so there's a huge learning curve in terms of getting the information out there and developing the best kind of practices for implementing this policy.
Great. Well, we have another question. For others, states that may be looking to do something similar, what suggestions do you have? And maybe, Gabrielle, you were just talking about education now that needs to take place, but maybe you can even talk a little bit more about the education that took place in Ohio to make this possible.
Sure. Well, I'll start, and I'm sure, I mean, I know the Ohio Public Defender's Office does a number of trainings around the state as well, and the Children's Law Center has done a lot of sort of outreach around different issues in the juvenile system in Ohio over the years, as well as a number of other folks. But I guess the first thing I'd start with is the importance of a real team effort. I mean, this as I mentioned at the beginning, is really the product of a number of people who chose to really put a lot of time and effort and energy into this project. And so that's everywhere when I talk about leadership and team, it's everything from the sort of legislative and executive kind of leadership and the judges. I mean, Justice Stratton and McGee Brown, who originally pulled a group together, and the juvenile judges that you've mentioned, Teresa Delick and Linda Teodosio, among many others who were really active in this effort. But also, experts around the state. The Center for Innovative Practices has been very much involved and of course the data that we get from places like the University of Cincinnati and others, advocates like Voices for Housed Children and Juvenile Justice Coalition and Children's Defense Fund, you know, all of having a strong and informed and committed group of professionals and individuals and citizens, I think, is what makes it a a strong effort. And by the way, you know, it doesn't hurt to have financial support. I think the MacArthur Foundation, Gunn Foundation, among potentially other funders. I'm not sure who all was involved in that, but having that support is really helpful too. So building a strong team, I think, from the beginning is a really important piece of that. One other thing I'd say in terms of what I think we learned is that to move as quickly away or avoid any discussion of whether this is a Republican or Democratic or, you know, conservative or progressive agenda. It's not progressive or conservative politics. It's common sense politics. You know, it's really what makes sense, and using data to inform that decision making process and having examples of evidence-based programs that work and highlighting those in your state if you have those, or highlighting those from around the country if you don't, I think really builds the strongest, most compelling case then it makes sense. When people actually hear the data and the facts and what's available as other opportunities, another way to think about how we do this work, it's not as difficult a case, I think, to make, because it really isn't one that's based on sort of partisan politics.
Jill, did you have anything you'd like to add there?
Well, just in terms of maybe on the national level, I know that my office works quite a bit, as much as we can anyway, with some national groups. I mentioned that we consulted with Campaign for Youth Justice on the reverse waiver provision, and that allows us an opportunity to learn from a national group about what is happening in other states, what is being successful, what isn't working, so that we can make good, informed decisions that we, you know, may be able to implement then here in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So consulting with national groups, I think, is such a great opportunity. A couple others I would like to mention are the National Juvenile Defender Center. They are full of resources and are always a wonderful group to learn from. They have members from all over the country talking about what's happening in their states, again, what's working and what's not working, and then also Juvenile Law Center, which is a great organization in Pennsylvania, and they do great advocacy work there. And so just from the national point of view, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of discussions that are happening, and most of it is geared toward, at least on the advocacy side, towards, again, moving away from this whole idea of if you do the crime, you do the time mentality, and looking at really what is cost effective and at the same time what works better to lower recidivism. And that goes to what Gabriella was saying, is we can all sit in the same room and have this conversation, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, whether you're a juvenile advocate or, a conservative who's looking at the budget. You can have this discussion and may have your own reasons for wanting to move forward, but find that you do agree at the end what's best for kids and what's best for your state.
Great. I just want to remind our listeners that if they do want to ask a question on air, that telephone number is 347-994-1149, and then you would press the number 1 on your keypad. Is there anything either of you would like to add about sort of the legislative climate? You know, we talked about leaders around the state. Was there anything particular to the Ohio legislation?
Yeah, well, I'd certainly like to do a few shout-outs, if you will, because we wouldn't – I mean, the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, when you're looking at policy legislative change, it, you know, we can have the best information possible, you know, the most compelling case, but without really leadership, both executive leadership, which we had here with the governor's office, and Director Harvey Reid when he came in, but also at legislative leadership. I mean, Speaker Batchelder was a very strong leader at the very beginning, which made a huge difference, I think, in our state and helped to bring a number of his colleagues along. So when we were on the House side, his leadership was, you know, indispensable, along with other representatives like Representative Blessing and Lynn Slaby. And then on the Senate side here, you know, Senator Grindel was instrumental in moving this forward out of his committee and the support of President Niehaus. But we also had, you know, originally Bill Seitz and Representative Tracy Hurd, who were folks on the original legislation, adult criminal sentencing legislation and juvenile legislation, who continued to be real leaders. So I think that kind of consistent, and you can really count on these professional legislators who took in a lot of information and used that information. That was very, very important to us, that we had an audience that would listen to the case that was being made. So that kind of that climate, it was just a very encouraging place to be working with and be a part of a team that was working with a number of those folks. And I, you know, I think Jill's mentioned a number of the national people too, and we've probably already mentioned a number of the other people, but I don't know if there's other folks, Jill, you wanted to mention as well.
Well, I don't want to forget the Department of Youth Services and their director, Harvey Reid.
Mm-hmm.
It was really an amazing couple of days when we were sitting over at the State House and listening to testimony. Virtually all of which, if not all of which, was proponent testimony in favor of House Bill 86. And that testimony was not just coming from defense or juvenile advocates, but also from the Department of Youth Services.
Right.
And the director, Harvey Reid, testified in favor of these changes, which I thought was instrumental in showing this team effort and that we really were looking for change and that we were in agreement as to, you know, what Ohio needed. And some that have been mentioned, but I think are worthy of mentioning again, Justice Stratton with the Supreme Court of Ohio heads the Advisory Committee on Mental Illness in the Courts. And it's because of her leadership and her committee and the work that was done for years and years on the juvenile competency piece, that really finally was able to come to be. And that was years of hard work and compromise and struggle and meeting after meeting after meeting and give and take on a lot of people's parts. But we were finally able to get there. And I think the end result is actually a very good competency product that we now have. And also along with Justice Stratton, Justice McGee Brown, who's the newest member of the Supreme Court of Ohio, and then also Judge Teodosio and Judge Delek. And again, listening to their testimony, I thought was very, very moving to our legislators, to hear from the judges and to hear their frustrations with mandatory sentencing and, you know, basically putting it before them that they are the judges and they should be
mm-hmm.
making these decisions, and they're seeing bad outcomes because they're not being given this discretion, and they're seeing things that they don't want to have to do because of a mandatory law. And so I thought that was just very moving. And you could see our legislators, you could see their faces were, they were impressed. And I think that they were very moved by hearing their stories.
So where do we go from here? What's next? And maybe what are some of the major challenges ahead for juvenile justice work in Ohio?
Do you want to take a start on that one, Jill?
I can try. I'll start.
Because there's so much. There's always more to do.
There's always more to do. That's the first thing, is to keep going. I mean, we obviously we have a lot of work to do with House Bill 86 still. We have a lot of trainings, and we have to make sure that people have the information that they need to put these new provisions into place. But it's also a first step. And I heard that from a lot of our legislators, and I heard that from our governor when he signed House Bill 86, that this is a first step. And that was a wonderful thing to hear, because we do have more to do, and there's a lot more we could do in terms of, you know, continuing this move away from mandatory bindover and mandatory sentencing. We still have a lot of those types of sentencing laws in Ohio. You know, we still have mandatory bindover. And so anytime we can move away from those mandatory laws, in the juvenile court system especially, they're moving away from them to some extent in the adult, but, you know, in the juvenile context, it's even more important. So steps in that direction. I think if we can
I, on that one, Jill, can I add something to that on the mandatory? Because I think this is a really critical point, and I'm not sure if sort of the general public always gets why the sort of mandatory nature is so especially sort of debilitating, really, in the juvenile system, because it completely deprives you know, the judge and really that youth and our communities from a full hearing and understanding of what's happening in that young person's life. And we automatically then are sending kids away. We automatically are choosing to spend thousands and thousands of dollars on an intervention that we have no idea, and often some idea that it's not going to work, and certainly no idea if it will work. And we all lose as a result of that mandatory practice. There's no reason not to spend a little bit more time up front with a full sort of hearing of the information to better understand what's going on in that the circumstances involving in a particular case, what was going on with that youth, what resources that youth family may or may not be able to bring to the table, what the victim situation might have been involved in a situation. I mean, there's just no opportunity for any of that when we had this mandatory approach. And it makes no sense when you look at when you understand principles of adolescent development, but also when you look at our fiscal reality and our treatment reality, that approach is so backwards that it's something that we've begun to make a little bit of headway here, and it's really a truly remarkable thing, I think, to move the ship in that direction that HB 86 does for young people. But there is so much more that can be done to really say, let's take a real look at each young person. And it doesn't have to take necessarily a whole lot of time or resources to do it. And again, I think when we do it at the beginning, we're so much more likely then to make some better decisions up front that will impact those kids, it'll impact their families, it impacts the public, and all in a positive way.
So you have absolutely no feelings about that whatsoever.
Yeah, I have very... This is one that, you know, and it's just bears out when you look at and when you understand the sort of complexity of not even complexity, the sort of simple reality of where children are at developmentally and what a youth crime often involves. There may be group context involved. I mean, there's just so much to consider that we do not consider when we use that mandatory approach. And we're all stuck, by the way. The public is stuck footing the bill for that and bearing the consequences of that, not just that individual child.
Were there other things?
Yeah, I know, Jill, you were going to talk about some other things there.
Oh, no, that's fine. And I couldn't agree more with everything that Gabriella was saying. I mean, that's the whole idea behind the juvenile justice system, and it's why those of us who work in the juvenile justice system do what we do, so that we can, you know, try and get these kids the services they need, the treatment that they need, so that they can correct or learn from their behavior and have a better, brighter future. I mean, that's the whole reason we get into this business. And so when you talk about mandatory sentencing, it's very frustrating for all of us who want to do right by these kids, whether you're a prosecutor or a defense or a judge or a court administrator. It doesn't matter who you are. If you're in the system, you're doing it because you love kids and you want to help them live a better life. And so moving away from this mandatory is so, so very important. And in addition to that, limiting, at least from my perspective, limiting the number of kids we send to the adult criminal system. We are sending, I think, currently over 300 kids a year into the adult criminal justice system. And when the law was originally created in Ohio, it was meant to allow for certain kids, few, you know, the most violent, the most lost to society, if you will, kids, to be moved into the adult system. If the juvenile system was just absolutely not going to work for them, they were not subject to rehabilitation, which is a concept I struggle with because I think most, if not all, kids are subject to rehabilitation if they just get the treatment services that they need. But Bindover was supposed to be very limited, and we're sending more than 300 kids a year into the adult system, and I think that's just way too many. And many of those children, I think, are amenable to rehabilitation. And the adult system doesn't make them better. And many of them are released in short periods of time, and they return to their communities, and their recidivism rates are high. And we're not doing a service to those kids or to the communities by sending them into the adult system.
And can I add on that one, Jill, too?
Yes.
Because, you know, I think there's another common sort of perception that we're sending up basically the worst of the worst, you know, into the adult system. But the Columbus Dispatch did an investigation of this several years ago, and they actually found that when they looked at those bindovers, those young people who were sent into the adult system were saying, we cannot do anything with you in the juvenile system. We're transferring you to the adult system. 20% were charged with low-level felonies, which include things like drug abuse, receiving stolen property, assault and theft. So we're not, it's not always what one might consider the worst of the worst, right? But even, I think, more distressingly, in understanding the impact of a young person in the adult system, there's lots of research out there now by Forrest and Associates and others that look at what happens to a young person in the adult prison. We know that youth in adult prisons are 5 times more likely to be sexually assaulted. They're twice as likely to be beaten by staff and 50% more likely to be attacked with a weapon than youth in juvenile facilities. And the suicide rate, I think, is it's like 8 times higher for youth in adult facilities. So, you know, the other thing is actually the laws of, you know, sending youth into the adult system. We want to, you know, make them do the time and, you know, have a sort of this criminal punitive approach. These are meant to deter bondover youth, but we actually find that they're more likely to reoffend when you compare it to similar youth who are maintained in the juvenile system. So it doesn't serve future victims of potential crimes when we do this. So again, this is where we need to go from here, but it's also about being smart about our policies and how we choose to spend public dollars, not just being sort of knee-jerk reactions to what we think, you know, should happen.
And I'd like to let the listeners know we actually have a show scheduled on the transfer of youth to the adult system for early November and all of the problems with that. So if people want to learn more, to tune into that show. We're quickly running out of time, so I just want to hear your thoughts about what resources are needed around Ohio or what you know may be in development right now for those interested in learning more about HB 86 provisions.
Sure. You know what, I'm actually, I know that there are a number of sort of training and education opportunities that are sort of specific to each audience, so whether it's judges or public defenders or others, and I think, Jill, you've been working on a number of those things, so maybe you want to talk about that, and then I could add something at the end maybe if it's helpful.
Sure. I know there are a number of seminars being planned for defense attorneys, public defenders, three of which I'm aware of right now. So if you are a public defender or handle juvenile delinquency cases, the Central Ohio Association of Juvenile Lawyers, or COJAL, is holding a seminar in Columbus, and that is on September 23rd. The State Bar Association is also holding a seminar on September 29th. That will also be in Columbus. That, to my knowledge, is going to focus on the competency piece of House Bill 86, where the COJAL will be a training on all the different provisions that are going into effect on September 30th. My office, the State Public Defender's Office, is also hosting a public defender seminar. That will be in October. I believe that is October 28th. And in the meantime, in the interim, my office and Children's Law Center is in the process of developing a number of fact sheets on the reverse waiver, the judicial release, the gun specification, and the competency laws. So those fact sheets we hope will be valuable resources to anyone who wants to learn more about the new provisions. And those are going to be placed on the Children's Law Center website and the State Public Defender's Office website as well. Our website is www.opd.ohio.gov, and hopefully those will be placed on there in the next week or so.
Yeah, and I would just add two things. One is, if anyone listening to this is interested in training, and you say you're a psychologist, I would encourage you to actually go to your associations, or if you're a provider, you know, going to the Ohio Association of Child Care and Agencies or some other, and saying, I think it would be helpful to have some kind of training or education session on this. And I know that Jill and I are among, you know, a number of other folks who'd be happy to try and attend those if we can be helpful. But to really ask your colleagues to host a training and get good information out there. The Schubert Center is going to be doing a session really on the role of how, in this particular case, how you bridge research with policy on October 11th here at the Case campus, and information for that can be found on the Schubert website as well.
And do you want to give that website out?
Oh, well,
you want
sure.
me to do it?
We can put it up. Do you? Yeah, sure. It's just SchubertCenter. Case.edu, I believe, is the website.
All right. Final thoughts from either of you.
Well, I want to say a couple things. Just one, it's been really an incredible opportunity for me personally in my work to work with such a terrific group of people. And so I've been really grateful for this opportunity. And I think when we look at HB 86, that we've all said it's a very good first step. There's still more work that needs to be done. What I find, though, that's really remarkable about this is that 86 begins to promote what we know to be in, really best practice for young people. It promotes what we know about adolescent development, and that kids are kids, and so we should respond accordingly, hold them accountable accordingly, treat them accordingly, create opportunities accordingly, and that there's really this larger public benefit as a result of this work, and that that we can see. Those are my final thoughts on 86.
And I absolutely agree. This is hopefully a first step. I'm never going to forget hearing those words come out of the governor's mouth, and hopefully hold him to it, because it's such important work. And in 12 years that I've been involved working with juvenile justice, this is the first piece of legislation in Ohio that we have been proponents of. And so we're so very hopeful that this is the first step moving in the right direction and moving away from all of this criminalization and over-incarceration, and start doing what's really best for kids, what's best for their families, and what's best for communities. And so hopefully we'll have more to come in the future.
Well, I wanted to thank both of you so much for being on today and also for the dedication that both of you had to seeing these reforms through to fruition. And hopefully maybe we can have you back on in the future when we've had some time to settle in and see what actually has been the impact. So to stay informed about the upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center website at www.childrenslawky.org, and we will try to post all training related to HB 86 there. So take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth, and thank you again, Jill and Gabriella.
Thank you.
Thank you.